It's Japanese. So
Japanese,
it's,
so yes.
Nakata-san.
Nakata-san. Right. Well, Professor, welcome to welcome to Mount Isa. Can I ask what brings you to Mount Isa?
It's a trip I've been planning to do for since I got here about a year and a bit ago, to try and learn a little bit about some of the health programs run out here in relation to JC's program.
Okay.
And also very keen to hook up with the indigenous organizations who provide a lot of services and good services in the region. I've read a bit about them and understand the basics about what they do, but you can't get better information but other than being on the ground. And so my first opportunity was now, and after a bit, and I've jumped on the plane regardless of the flu to get here.
Oh, good man.
Only this morning.
Good man. So what is your role then in with JCU?
My role is as the Pro Vice Chancellor of Indigenous Education and Strategy to help the university develop its priorities for Indigenous people in the arts sector, particularly for the North Queensland region, and to give some guidance on how to do that across the universities in the different colleges and division. But primarily bring a heightened emphasis around getting Indigenous graduates through their degree programs.
How do you sort of coax or encourage Indigenous people
to... It's a problem that has been encountered by all universities and all Indigenous centres, and we've struggled with this over the last 40 years. And the national data in this area suggests, you know, we're still struggling to do that. But I've been working on a very different agenda to how that can be done, essentially through a lot of research work that we've been doing around in what Indigenous academic assistance is. Academic persistence. It's an area of research work in the educational field that we know about in the with other kids, but very little has been done in relation to Indigenous academic persistence.
Yeah.
So how do we understand kids going through their studies and how they confront challenges, how they surmount that, and what they learn from that? Does it turn into a habit of practice? Does that practice actually correlate with their performance? So we've studied that over the last 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
And prior to that, we had been studying student learning support issues as well, and arrived at the position some time back about what needs to be done with the learning support agenda from that knowledge. And it's allowed us to be able to develop a far-reaching learning support services that takes kids through their degrees at a...
What's the main finding of that then, in terms of recommendations for?
Well, that you can't really get underprepared Indigenous kids in through higher education studies, just on remediating the educational issues. There has to be a element of a capacity building of them individually as learners, so that they have the skills and knowledge set to be able to undertake higher education learning. So you can't just really remediate the situation of impoverished schooling to somehow capture 12 years of neglect and then have them perform in a higher education study at the rate of other kids. So remediation, we know, has some effect, but it doesn't really take us all the way to the bank. So what we're trying to do is understand the intricacies of those characteristics of the learning development cycle and scaffold learning support strategically to that as they go through, so that they get timely support, but very proactive support, so that we're actually not just reacting to situations, but actually building up capacity.
Okay.
So it's a preemptive kind of measure to learning development, rather than know that there's a problem, watch them fall over, and then try and remediate a situation. Mm-hmm. So it's a different kind of triage, if you like.
Yeah.
That is, it's And so the biggest lesson for us is, if you can get a balance of the remediation work with a very targeted capacity building agenda on their, particularly to do with their learning capacity, and a targeted pastoral support, you have the building blocks then of actually allowing them to progress at rates as other kids do. Mm. And so we've done this at University of New South Wales, and we've had a 5-year case study on it, and we actually showed that the kids that going through services that we have been providing, they pass through at a rate higher than the sector average for all kids. Okay.
Wow. And
so we compete, as you know, in Mount Isa with the mining industry.
Yes.
And services industry. So you can get a well-paid job in the mine and a good career. Mm. You can do a trade sponsored by your employer, become a qualified tradie, a boilermaker or electrician, any number of trades which young men and women take up and are gainfully employed. And so trying to attract kids into uni, we're competing in that environment.
Yes.
And in health, we're competing with the world is your oyster, because a few years ago it was really, for women it was nursing and teaching, and for men it was teaching and accountancy maybe, but the world's your oyster now, and all of the health professions are open to everybody, and so we compete with each other, but then we're competing with everything else, so it's science and engineering and architecture, and so the world is much more open to kids from the bush and genders, and so it's even more important that we're trying to raise awareness and aspirations and compete reasonably. So at this town and region to survive and thrive, we need the people who live here and who are related to the area to, they're the best ones to take it forward with whatever's going to happen in the future. So we want accountants and lawyers and doctors and nurses and dentists and pharmacists and beef producers and the next, whoever's going to invent the next equivalent to the road train that just radically changed the bush 60 years ago.
Yep.
That was invented, you know, out of Alice. That next big invention could come out of here.
Okay.
That will change how we live and work up here and how profitable our industries are. Mm. We want the locals to be a part of that. And so it's really important that we work closely with Martin to make sure that the Aboriginal kids and Torres Strait Islanders, because we, as you know, we've got a small community here who work here in the region and are related to people, have that best opportunity to get in. And so we want to learn from what he's doing and work out how we can put our shoulders to the wheel to support that. As you know, we beaver away on the rural remote agenda out here. But they have a much bigger agenda, which is the not only North Queensland, but the whole tropical world, sort of the torrid zone, and where we fit in that.
So, Martin, have you noticed in your research any sort of differences between the two Indigenous groups, between the Torres Strait Islanders and Aboriginal groups in terms of the pathways to learning? Or is it similar to both?
They're very different people, of course.
Yep.
But when we're talking about learning development, this is in relation to formal learning. So whichever Indigenous group you come from, you're still encountering a formal learning environment.
Right.
And so that makes it very similar. Mm-hmm. In regards to the characteristics about how they engage and confront challenges, it's pretty much the same. Islanders have a more difficult situation with the language issues because they have a lot more presence of a traditional language. So second language one is actually a bit of a problem. But other than that, they're fairly similar because you're trying to encounter and break into a Western language code.
Mm.
And sciences and schemas that are quite alien, and so we built a position outside of it, looking into it and struggling with the same areas as we go forward, some with second language difficulties because we can't read the text as well as a first language person, and I'm a second language learner as well, so I understand that intimately. Mm-hmm. One thing definitely the same about both is that they both remind us that Indigenous kids aren't silly. They're not stupid. You know, they have the capability and faculties as any other kid. God didn't have one that says, oh, you're black, you get this one, and white, you get this one. We have the same physiological beginning, but somehow socially and historically we've created different positions about that and expectations about that. So, and that resonates all the way through how we talk to each other across different cultures, how we teach them in classroom. And so the manifestation of those kind of behaviors are there, definitely. And our kids have to confront that, you know. And but once you strip away a lot of that stuff and you get down to the learning engagement, the proper formal learning engagement, it is really about how to domesticate content and schemas that aren't your own. And so they recognize these same challenges. You can see them in how they try and encounter that. And we've learned from the behaviors and their responses to that quite a lot that teaches us about it's not really how we put more Indigenous content into the curriculum. It's how we tool up the Indigenous kids to for the encounter with foreign knowledge. And so what we've done over the years is to try and focus there and develop the kids' capacity to be tooled up to do that. And where we've done it, and we've seen success after success.
It strikes me there's a lot of similarity. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Tammy Weber in the... So she seems to be working in similar kinds of areas about... And again, it's about capacity, seems to me to be about capacity building rather than necessarily...
It's an old term that we use in the early days, particularly around community development and Indigenous organisational development and building capacity to be part of the self-determination agenda. I've recruited that term here, particularly for learning capacity. And it's familiar to everybody, and it signals a priority for Indigenous needs, not what's being done to Indigenous people, where most of the emphasis is. So you know, we have a lot of emphasis over the last 20 years on Indigenous areas, and we emerge things like cultural awareness, but cultural awareness programs are primarily for white people. And our kids who suffer from that don't necessarily have a program to help them. So we're operating in different universes sometimes, I feel, where we think we're doing Indigenous stuff, but we're actually not. And more resources is going that way still, and not enough going to tooling up our kids to be prepared and able to defend themselves no matter what they confront. We have the programs for that, you know. So we've been trying different things, and what I'm trying to do across the university, and why I'm talking to people in the community, is really, can we tweak stuff here to get the priority to shift slowly back to Indigenous kids? So my role in the Indigenous Centre at James Cook is really to bring learning support services front and centre of the business, just to recalibrate the priorities, and to start the big exercise, which is to change the narrative about the priorities for Indigenous people.
Good stuff. Thank you very much. We appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, thanks.
Interview lady, want to add anything?
No, we're just.